Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you'll enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. So let's see. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org and view the online calendar of upcoming club events. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Alain Salant of Carbon 5. Alain is founder and owner of Carbon 5, a software development firm dedicated to delivering high-value software through an agile collaboration with its clients, with offices in San Francisco and Los Angeles. Carbon 5 clients include Charles Schwab, National Geographic, SF MoMA, LeapFrog, Chronicle Books, Kashi Kellogg's, and startups including Aardvark, Power Reviews, Radar Networks, and Invinfolio. Alain has over 10 years' experience delivering web applications to his clients. His areas of expertise include agile coaching, software design, automated testing, and rubber hits the road software development. He's written articles and book contributions for O'Reilly and has spoken at South by Southwest, Web 2.0 Expo, Java 1, CodeCon, and Bay Area user groups on technology and process topics. Alain holds a degree in mathematics from the University of Pennsylvania. Alain is also an avid gardener, surfer, and mountain biker, and has been teaching bicycle maintenance and repair for 4 years as a volunteer mechanic at the San Francisco Bike Kitchen. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Alain Salant.
Thanks, Kevin, for the great introduction. Thank you, everyone, for joining me tonight, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event. So I'm here today as a builder, a craftsman, someone who takes intense pride in the quality of the work we do at Carbon 5, and also who has an intense fascination in process and the ways we get work done and the ways we can collaborate and work together. So what I have to share with you today are some insights on the state of the art of our thinking in how to collaborate and work together, how to fail early and often, and succeed in the long run. Bear with my remote here. There we go. Catastrophic failure sucks. So this is fear. This is the big fail that we all try and avoid. Blowing our budgets, missing critical deadlines, failing to raise customers for our product, launching, having it out there, nobody cares. Running out of money before we even get to market. So these are the big fails. But we all agree that learning from your mistakes is great. What happens when you learn from your mistakes? You realize you messed up. You think about what happened. You evaluate. You think about what you could do better next time. And you feed that feedback, your own thoughts, your own ideas about how to do it better the next time, into your next attempt. This is how we learn. So, inspirational quotes I made from James Dyson, the inventor of the Dyson vacuum cleaner. I made 5,127 prototypes of my vacuum before I got it right. There were 5,126 failures, but I learned from each one. That's how I came up with a solution. Bear with me here. John Allspaugh, earlier this year at the Velocity Conference run by O'Reilly, speaking about Flickr operations. These are the guys that keep the lights on at Flickr. If you think you can prevent failure, then you aren't developing your ability to respond. So, insights from these initial inspirations. We want to embrace our mistakes. It's a healthy process, healthy part of learning. Make them happen regularly and often and reliably. How can you, if learning from your mistakes is good, how can you create a control process for making mistakes, for having that feedback, for feeding it back into the work that you do so that you can be successful in the long run? So we've got some solutions that can help us. Thank you. So how do we do this? There are techniques in planning. There are processes for how people interact and work together. There are design practices, and there are technology solutions that give us structure for making mistakes and learning, feeding back in all aspects of the work that we do. In this room here, I think we've got software developers, we've got designers, we've got entrepreneurs and business owners. We all have our process, we all have techniques that we're using, and they all can feed into this learning and agile mind. So in the work that we do, this is often the source or the risk for catastrophic failure. We plan too big. So what does this mean? Typically, the way we see this is a client comes to us and they have a vision for a product they want to create, a company they're starting and a product they want to create. And they're so focused on that end goal that they lose sight of what it takes to get there. You think about that end goal and view all the steps towards that end goal as transitional, rather than ends in their own, ends in themselves. It's a common metaphor and it's a common way of thinking for a lot of things that we find in the world today. Launching rockets, it is a big launch. It's something that doesn't happen until you get there. Building buildings, one of the most abused metaphors in software development, is another one. You don't have a building to occupy and use until you've gone through the design and the construction and the renovation and the move-in. But in web software, it's not this way. You can build something initially, incrementally, add on to it, get a lot of value out of your incremental work, and reduce the risk of failing catastrophically trying to go to a big launch. When you're thinking in this way, when you're looking so far ahead and view all the steps to get there as incremental, you have to wait to answer certain questions. Are we on time? Are we on budget? Do we have enough money to get to that endpoint? Will this thing that I'm building work for me? Can I use it to run my business? Or will my customers use it? If I put it out there, is it even going to be appealing? Is it even something that they can use? This is the classic big launch technique or process in software development that was the kind of the state of the art and the way people did things until the early 2000s, when new ideas were starting to come out and be practiced by software developers. So what is this? This is when you have a software project, when you're building a product, you start out, you get your requirements together, figure out what you need to do, what you're building, you design your solution, you build it, you implement it, you test it, you launch it, you put it out there, you see if it sticks, you go into maintenance, maybe you come back and do it again. But the cycle for doing this is months, sometimes years in big companies. In the projects that we do, this might be a 6-month cycle. You have to wait until you complete each phase to find out if you were successful in that phase, and you have to wait until the very end to find out if you were successful at all. So big risk for catastrophe here. Carbon 5's biggest overall project fail was at least in part related to trying to work this way. So this was our first project, new company. This is 10 years ago. So 2000, Web 1.0 startup, the very tail end of that time. The company was a startup that was doing equipment leasing online. And the founder was actually a NASA scientist. He'd been involved in the design of rockets. He also was a successful businessman, owned a chain of department stores. And so he came to this project with success and behind him, but also expectations about what it takes to get things done. And Carbon 5 came to this project with similar expectations. The work that we've been doing at our individual companies in the boom, we've been working in much the same way also. So what ended up happening was we embarked on this project. We went through these phases, requirements, design, implementation. We got close to the end, and we were way off. We built a ton of great infrastructure, great tools on which we were going to build features, But in the time that we had left, we weren't going to make our targets. We'd also failed through some inexperience. The client had come back with new features and changes, and we hadn't managed that process well. But in the end, we faced a situation where we started pulling all-nighters, you know, really kind of tapping ourselves out, and had to go back to the client and essentially renegotiate our deliverable. We'd already put in way more time than we'd planned and had specified for the project. We were able to kind of push because there had been changes in the scope, and we used that as a technique for renegotiating. We ended up delivering the client something that worked and had some good tools and infrastructure, but wasn't something you'd put in front of his clients or in front of his users. And the tragedy here is there were so many opportunities to find out that things were off track and to fix the problems long before we got to the end of that project. If we'd had the means with which to measure our progress or to show our client what we were doing, if we'd been able to not wait until the end of implementation to find out if we had enough time left to actually test and deliver this product, we would have been able to address the concerns that had come up. So I'm going to talk about iteration a fair amount in this presentation. Simple definition: iteration is the repetition of successive steps of refinement. The idea here is to actually perform an activity, to do a bunch of work, and to actually get to a stopping point, to get to an end goal, and then to repeat those activities, feeding back the result of the first round into the second round, into the third round, progressively moving towards your product, your vision, the point that you're moving towards. This is a process that may never end. You can always refine. You can always get better. You can always add. A little bit about me. I'm a chicken. So we run a consulting company. We do work with a lot of entrepreneurs where risk is a common characteristic in their ventures. But they hire us to mitigate that risk for them. They hire us to do work every day, every week. We get paid for the work that we do, so we're not overextending ourselves into the high-risk nature of their venture. But we are on the line for delivery. We're on the line for putting product in their users' hands, for making sure it's stable, usable, up, and available. Otherwise, they can't run their business. So I'm personally very motivated, and Carbon 5 is very motivated, to find ways to mitigate those risks and to be successful in what is essentially a high-risk practice. I've mentioned startups a couple times. Not all of our business is with early-stage companies. We do probably about 50% of our businesses with early-stage companies, but they're worth mentioning here because they are the place, or they are the clients with whom we learn the most and where a lot of the things that I'm talking about tonight come from. Startups, first of all, as I just mentioned, it's a high-risk environment. Many entrepreneurs get into their startup ventures knowing that they have a high risk of failure. It's actually a badge of honor for many. I was at a conference a couple months ago. FailCon is a local San Francisco conference for developers, designers, entrepreneurs, investors. And David Hornick there from August Capital actually said that VCs pay tuition for the entrepreneurs that they invest in. It's not uncommon for those entrepreneurs to fail, but they expect that the result of that failure to produce learning so that the next time they go into a venture with that entrepreneur, they're much more likely to be successful. So they're establishing a relationship, and they're investing in the experience that comes through trying and failing. The other thing that's interesting for us about startups and why we like working with them is they're very malleable. Usually you're working with just a couple founders. They've got all the say about how things are going to go. They tend to be experimental. They're trying something new anyway. So when we work with them, we have a lot of influence. We don't have to deal with corporate politics and things like that. So we can come in with our own ideas. Usually they've come with their vision, an idea of the product they want to build, and we can come with our own ideas about execution and have a fair amount of influence there. They're also creative, and they challenge us to try different ways of doing things, and so out of that comes a lot of learning. We then take that learning and those practices and can apply them to all the work we do when we're working with Charles Schwab or working with SF MoMA. this is what's exciting today for me. We're seeing essentially a convergence of process from different domains, design, software development, product marketing. And what we're seeing is that there's a family of processes being performed by people who have different disciplines that share these common attributes of early and frequent learning and adjustment. They're agile software development, user-centered design, and customer development. And I'm going to talk about each one in detail. So agile software development. This is home base for Carbon 5. Agile is the name for a set of practices that people started to formalize in late 90s, early 2000s. And the name agile was used as an alternative to lightweight. People were talking about these processes as being lightweight as opposed to heavyweight, that heavyweight waterfall process, a lot of upfront documentation, a lot of upfront planning. So agile was a term that a group of folks who had individual labels on their processes started to use to indicate that they shared common values and a common way of going about building software. Their shared values were communication and collaboration, responding to change, sustainability, and a high priority on quality. Some of the practices that came out of those values, early and continuous delivery of working software. So this is one that's worth mentioning. The idea here is to always have a product in your hands, even if it's an early version, but something working, something you can interact with, and to always keep it working, and to build your product up through a series of enhancements to working software. Another practice, setting a pace and practices that can continue indefinitely. This is the sustainability message. And regular reflection and adjustment, so feedback back into the process about how you're doing, how you can do better. In the design world, user-centered design is a well-established practice. This is a set of practices that involve upfront research, engaging your users, testing, surveys, prototypes, running experiments, getting feedback on your ideas, on your hypothesis about what your product should be like, and then feeding that back into your next iteration and going and testing again. We often see user-centered design done up front, so kind of in that waterfall process, up front in the requirements and design side of things. But it doesn't have to be. It can actually be a set of values and a set of practices that you incorporate all the way through product development, after your release, and through the process of enhancing the product you already have in customers' hands. The third, customer development. So this is an outlier, less established, less well-known, but something that's inspiring Carbon 5 today. Steve Blank wrote a book, Four Steps to the Epiphany. His insights were that while there's rigor around design practices, visual design, interaction design practices, while there's rigor around software development, there's much less rigor out there around the process of taking a product concept and actually creating a product that meets the needs of a market. So his fundamental idea is that what you need to do if you're a startup or if you have a new product idea, the first thing you need to do is get out of the four walls of your organization and go and test that product idea against the market that that product is for. You have a hypothesis here. My product idea is going to be appealing to 18 to 25-year-olds who like mobile devices. But you've got to go outside your four walls and find out. Chances are you're actually going to be wrong. The fit that you expected to find is not going to be the fit that you find when you get out there. So what do you do? You revise your product concept or you switch the market. Maybe you're so in love with your product you've got to go look for a different market to sell it to. And that's a fine way to go. So he's got this idea of testing your hypothesis about the product market fit and iterating on that until you find the right fit. So here's the inspiration, really. We talked about processes from the design world, from the product marketing world, from the development world. They all share these three common attributes: iteration, experimentation, and reflection. Talk about each one. Iteration. So this takes many forms. In the work that we do, we take that process, that waterfall process that we looked at, requirements, design, implementation, testing, release, and we try and compress that into the smallest possible time. If you think those steps are good, or if those steps work, why wait 6 months to complete the process? Why not try and do it in a month, or in 2 weeks, or in 1 week? If you do that, you're going to have that experience of having created something, having gone through all those stages, and having succeeded in some ways, and having failed in other ways. But what you do is you have the opportunity then to adjust and to feed back into the next time you go around. So when you're iterating, what you're trying to do is take a practice that typically you do over a long period of time and to compress the amount of time that it takes to do it. Doing that forces you to optimize. While that waterfall process has design and implementation and testing happening one after another, you might have to learn how to run them concurrently and how to have them feeding into each other as you go. And what you're doing here, one of the ideas here is kind of turning it up to 11 for you Spinal Tap fans. If it's good, if it's working for you, how can you do it more often? How can you do it more effectively, more efficiently? SFMOM was a client of ours. We worked with this past year to relaunch their website redesign. We worked with a partner, I think there's someone in the room here from Hot Studio, who worked with SFMOM over the course of a couple years to come up with a beautiful website redesign that strategically met the goals of the organization. SFMOM came to us with this document, like a 200-page design spec for what this website redesign would entail. They came to us also with a fixed budget and a timeline for when they needed to get this done. And they asked us, can you do this? Now, we had a long history of working on smaller projects with SFMOMA, so we were able to have a very transparent and frank conversation with them. And the answer was, probably not all of it, but you can't stop there. So where do you go from there? So the strategy that we took and the message that we tried to convey was that while we couldn't do all of it, we could do the most important parts. And the way that we would go about doing the most important parts was through a process of essentially prioritization and phasing. So the idea is that there are going to be elements of this design and the elements of the site that they want that are not going to be that important. If the site could go live without them. But how do you surface those things? So the way you surface those things is by focusing not on them, but on the things that really matter and building those first and building up the system that you're aiming for. So in this site, there's some examples of components or elements that had a high risk for blowing budget and time. Elements like the catalog search. There's a lot you can do with searching the SFMOMA catalog. Or the event calendar. There's a really rich interaction design around that. So what we did was we actually took this approach of building initial versions of those components, of the catalog search, of the event calendar, versions that met the need of helping users find the information they're looking for, seeing what events were coming up so they could go attend them at the SFMOMA, and then incrementally enhancing them over time. So we were able to get to a point where we had a releasable version of the SFMOMA site before we were out of budget or time, and then with the opportunity to enhance those components, time and resources permitting. So when we had a meeting a couple weeks before we launched the site, or before we were going into testing, with the primary stakeholder at SFMOMA, and we had this long backlog of items that we didn't think we were going to get to in the time that we had. And we asked him, you know, what of this stuff do we need to do in order to be able to launch the site? And he looked at it and he said, nothing. We've got everything that we need. So this process of setting an initial goal and then iterating on it greatly reduced the risk of failure. Before we'd even gotten to the end, we'd already mitigated that risk, and now we were just adding value over time. The second of these core practices, experimentation. This is the really exciting one. This is also the really challenging one. Experimentation is the process of having a hypothesis, testing it, evaluating the results, and feeding those results back into what you do the next time. We see experimentation in product design, in the development practices that we use at Carbon 5, and also in the working product that is actually out in users' hands. In product design, experimentation might take the form of prototypes. It might be a paper prototype of a feature of a user interaction that you're planning to build. You put it in front of users, you have them perform some activity, you get some feedback on whether it sticks or not. On While coding in the software development side, there's a practice that agile software developers use called test-driven development. This is a version, a little mini version of experimentation that they do every day or every hour of every day. You essentially, say we're implementing the catalog search on the SF MoMA site. You actually write some code that says, when I search for Matisse, I get back paintings by Matisse. You run your test, and it fails. You haven't written any code yet. You haven't built that component of the site. Your test failed, so what do? You go and you start to implement that feature, to implement that functionality. And you do that until your test passes. And you get this little rise. Oh, I was successful. That was great. And it's like solving a puzzle. Then you move on. You write the next test for the next enhancement, and then you write your code to satisfy that. So you get a couple things here. You have an iterative and incremental process where you're building up functionality. You get that personal pleasure of having solved a problem and getting the feedback of success. And you also get a code base of tests that asserts that your product is always working. So when you make changes in the future, you're not afraid that you've broken something else in some other part of the system. And then on the working product, people are talking quite a bit these days about A-B testing or split testing. This is one example of experimentation on the working product. This is the idea that a very common place where you see this is for optimizing a process like checkout in a shopping cart. So checkout in a shopping cart, a common metric that you measure is conversion. For number of people who start the checkout process, what percentage of people actually make a purchase? Companies are intensely motivated, as you can imagine, to optimize that process and to increase the conversion rate. There'll be people in an organization who have all kinds of theories about how to do that. How do you actually know what works? So one great way of doing this is actually to release two versions of your checkout flow, one to one set of users, one to another set of users, measure the difference, find the one that's more successful, and throw out the one that's not, and then do it again, and continually optimize towards that goal of increasing conversion. And that's just one example of many. Aardvark. These guys are a ton of fun when it comes to experimentation. They've actually been a source of quite a bit of inspiration for Carbon 5. They're a startup client of ours. We started working with them last year. And when we started, so Aardvark, the product, should explain that first, is in the domain of what they call social search. The experience is something like, I want to buy a bike to commute to work on in San Francisco. I've done some road bike, I've done some mountain bike, but I don't really know what kind of bike I should buy. It's a hard question to Google for, but somewhere out there, one of my friends probably has some really good advice for me. So Aardvark is a buddy of contact over IM or over email that you can ask a question of, and that will direct that question to a small group in your extended network that has the expertise to answer that question, and will broker the conversation between you and your answerers to get you an answer. Usually they get an answer back these days in less than 4 minutes. When we started working with Aardvark, they had spent a year prototyping different ideas for a product that they wanted to build. And the one that had stuck and the prototype they were running was they registered the Google IM account Aardvark. They had a guy sitting there with that account. They had 50 users in a spreadsheet. And if one of those users asked Aardvark a question, that human operator essentially would go to the spreadsheet and look and say, who can answer this question? Send them an IM and say, are you available? I have a question from Alon in San Francisco about bikes. And you could say, sure, or pass. And they'd say, well, here's the question, and get the answer. And then they'd turn around, and they'd send that answer back to the original asker. And what they found was that this interaction really worked for people who were participating in it. They really liked being asked questions as experts. And as askers, they found that the idea of getting answers from people who were connected to them, but maybe not directly, friends of friends, was valuable information. They were getting the subjective information. So we started working with them. They had this product, and we came in, and we come in with these values, iteration, working software early, and they were about to throw out this prototype and to start working with us to create Aardvark for real. And we said, hey, wait a second. You've got a product. You've got a working system. What can we do with the existing system to evolve it towards the vision that you have? So rather than tossing that and going to that big launch, catastrophic risk situation, what can we do today to build up to the vision that you have? So the process that we went through was to optimize the activities of that human operator. We built a system that that human operator could use to, instead of using a spreadsheet, search a database. The system actually did the IM communication and kept track of conversations. It enabled multiple operators to get involved so they could support the conversations that hundreds of users were having instead of just 50. Concurrently, they were building up the artificial intelligence system and the heuristics with which to answer questions automatically. So several months into the project, they were supporting thousands of users, five human operators, forwarding questions back and forth. The human operators at that point, all they were doing was identifying who could answer. They weren't managing the conversation at all. And then they swapped in the artificial intelligence and the heuristics for finding, for understanding what a question was about and who could answer it, and the human operators got out of the picture. Even then, when they were planning on doing that switch, they thought they were going to throw out the system that human operators were using and build up the system that did the automatic matching. But again, we said, wait, there are ways to evolve what you have today into what you want it to be. And through that, you mitigate all the risk of building something up that doesn't work. You always have something working. You're always evolving it forward. Today, Aardvark continues to be extremely experimental. They have practices like they can hijack the actual automated system to test features on unwitting users. So the example of book recommendations, they're thinking that if somebody answers with a book recommendation, we'll have Aardvark also send the link to the book on Amazon so they can make the purchase. So what they do is, what they've done is, instead of implementing that feature and see if it works, see if people like it, they actually can hijack the system, and when they see a book recommendation come by, they can follow up with a link to Amazon manually and see what the user does. Do they follow the link? Do they not follow the link? And they can follow up with them. Sometimes they'll follow up with them and ask them what that experience was like. Sometimes they'll just observe and let it go, and that user will never know that they were part of an experiment. So they've actually built a system with these experimental attitudes in that allow them to test and try their ideas. What they found is that about 50% of their good ideas, so after discarding all the bad ideas that come from a bunch of founders and product designers sitting around a table or come from suggestions from the users, after discarding the bad ones and looking at the good ones, they won't write any code until they've tested each idea. The way they run their tests vary widely. I've just given you a couple examples. And what they found out is they throw out 50%, more than half of their good ideas they throw out and never build. So they don't spend any time building unusable or uninteresting features. They spend more time on experimentation and testing, but only build those things that really have value. The third practice, reflection. So this is the meta practice in many ways. This is the process of evaluating your process. Many projects, many people in their projects, they do post-project retrospectives. You get everyone in the room, you talk about the project, what went well, what didn't go well, what are we going to do better next time? It's a great practice. It always helps an organization improve. If you think that's a good practice, though, why do you wait until the end of a project to do it? If you can do that practice, perform that practice weekly or every other week, not spend a lot of time doing it, if you can do it in 30 minutes, you're going to have an opportunity to optimize your practice, your processes, the product you're building, through the whole course of building your project. When you're reflecting, you're admitting that things go wrong. It's actually kind of a difficult process to make yourself do. And what you'll find is that for many of these things, iteration, experimentation, and reflection, while they're simple, they're not always easy. They require discipline. They require the desire to do them every day. And reflection is particularly one of those. Here's an example of one type of reflection. This is a meeting that Agile teams often run. It's not something that you have to be an Agile software developer to do. We actually did this a few weeks ago with an architect that I'm working with on a home renovation project. We're a couple months into the project, and at the end of a meeting, I said, can you give me 30 minutes? I want to run an exercise, something we do at work that I think might be valuable. And this is what we did. And reflections or retrospective meetings take many forms. This is just one. Handed out stickies to everyone in the room. There were five of us. And we had everyone take 5 minutes to write down on a sticky with a smiley face all the things that they were pleased about. What's going well in this project? What's working? What do you want to make sure we keep doing? And then with a frowny face, all the concerns. What makes you sad? What frustrates you? What risks do you feel? And so Everyone does that for 5 minutes. You throw them out on the table. You break the group in two. Give half the room the smileys, half the room the frownies. And you have them cluster them. Find those clusters of concerns and benefits that are common amongst the members of the team. And then you can take about 5 minutes to do that. And then take 20 minutes to talk about those clusters. Just talk about the big ones. Identify the things that are working. Make sure they're going to keep working, that you've got process and practice in place to repeat them. And then look at the concerns. Ideally, what you want to do is take the top two, three concerns and talk about what you can do to address them. Actionable, measurable things that you can do about them so that the next time you come back and do this reflection meeting, you can see if you've made progress. Ideally, you come back and one of those clusters is gone, two of them are gone, or three of them are gone, and the outliers, the ones you didn't talk about, are now the things to talk about. So there's some faith here that by addressing the top concerns, you'll get to the lesser concerns later. You don't have to do everything. The idea is you do this process with discipline, with rigor, and over time, you'll work your way through all the problems that are happening in your project. This one, for me, I find is surprisingly hard to do because I don't like admitting to myself and to my coworkers that things aren't going well. But you find if you do it, that it becomes easier, and the problems are never that big because you do it early. This is a project we're working on today. It's an example that I chose of a project in which all three of these practices, iteration, experimentation, and reflection, are working really well for us. The client is the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. They're a national nonprofit whose mission is to educate women 18 to 30 years old about birth control and to help them stay on birth control in order to have control over their reproductive lives. We're partnered with this project with IDEO, brought us in to work with the national campaign. And IDEO, for those of you who are not familiar with the company, they're a global company with a very strong identity in strategic design, the user-centered practices that I talked about, ethnographic research. They do industrial design. They design physical products. What was interesting here is they brought this heavily research and user-centered approach to this project. But IDEO very rarely is actually involved in the delivery side of things, in actually building things that work. Usually they're out of the picture and have handed off the strategic side or the product concept to somebody else who's then going to follow through. So while they do a lot of prototyping the work that they do, they stop there, and the prototype ends up being something that's just a tool towards getting to the product. In this project, what we ended up finding was that there were many open questions when we started working with IDEO and with the national campaign, and we needed to continue prototyping. The designer who was doing most of the web design had a lot of questions of his own that he couldn't answer with the prototypes he was able to build and the tests they were able to run at IDEO. So what we started doing was building working software. We scaled back the big vision and focused on those elements where the questions lay. And we built a first version, for example, of this component. This is a method explorer, and this is a tool for helping women navigate the many options for birth control and to end up being able to make their own decision, as opposed to recommending something to them, to make their own decision about what works for them. And what we're looking at here is actually the fourth iteration on this experience. The first iteration was tested with women through online tools that we sent it out to four different we used a service with usertesting.com, went out to six women. They sat at home on their computers with a script to run through. We ended up with a video of them interacting with the tool and a voiceover of what they were doing and thinking as they went through this. It's actually a service that I recommend to folks who are interested in low-cost user testing. It costs maybe 10, 20 bucks a person to do it. All you have to do is write a script, and you get a video back of them interacting with your application. We learned a ton from just four users. That some of that feedback confirmed some of the ideas we had of our own and gave us some new ideas of things we needed to work on. So then we revised it again. We actually had a release of this tool with some other components of the site a couple months into the project. And while we didn't promote it, it wasn't something that was actually promoted out to women 18 to 30, their target market. It was released to their partners at Planned Parenthood. It was released to women in a couple clinics that we actually went to and walked through these tools with. And so this project has definitely blurred the line between that big launch and something that's just kind of out there and in use and something that you can iterate on, their launch is actually going to be in 2011. So they're planning a global marketing campaign. You'll see it on the sides of buses, that kind of stuff. And what we've got is a system out there, though, that women are starting to use. They'll use in increasing numbers at targeted clinics through this year. And we're going to optimize and iterate on this so that when they do get to the big launch, we know it works. There's no risk of that failing, or low risk at least. Always risk. So we put it all together. We're iterating on product and process. We're experimenting, testing our ideas about the product that we're building, about the process we're using to do it. We're reflecting and adjusting what we do back into our next iteration. There's something fascinating that's happening here. Many of these practices, and I've only talked about a few, and you can go read about agile software development, user-centered design, and actually find little things like that reflection meeting I talked about, things you can do with your team in the work that you're doing yourselves. But what you'll find is that many of these practices are simple to do. You do them daily. And when you step back from your project and you look at 6 months of work, you won't see those daily little practices. What you see is this strangely organized structure over your project and over the team and the way your team is organized and the way your team is working together. There's this kind of emerging complexity that you find in biological systems and things like that that comes out of simple practices that work well together that you incrementally iterate on, and you end up with these complex solutions to complex problems. Challenges. This isn't always easy. The biggest challenge that we find when trying to encourage clients to work in this way or to adopt these values in the work that they do is existing culture. Many organizations have political culture or established processes that work directly against these values. It's hard. It's not an easy thing to do. You have to find a chink in the armor and maybe start doing it yourself or with just a couple people on your team and see how far you can expand that. This is something at Carbon 5 we had to do this early on. We called it style flexing. We would work with clients who had really rigorous expectations for what it meant to hire a consulting company, and we would try and work within their expectations but still perform many of these activities. You'll run up against territorialism. People are protective and defensive. They've got fear. They don't want to admit to their mistakes. They don't want to let you in and have the insight into and the transparency that you need to be able to collaborate in this way. We plan too big. Even in the work we do at Carbon 5, it's hard not to think about some big goal that you aspire to and to latch onto that and to not do the work it takes to find those incremental goals that deliver value on the way there. And the last one, of course, fear. Change is scary. But what can you do? You don't have to practice agile software development. You don't have to do user-centered design. You don't have to practice customer development. But if you can find something that works for you in the big picture, in the projects that you run, try and figure out how to do it more often, how to do it with less effort, how to do it, how to optimize that activity and to get incremental benefit out of it as you work. The other one, find a risk or a question, something you're worried about, something that generates anxiety, and figure out how to test it, how to bring it closer in time. How can you learn something about that problem or answer that question today or tomorrow with a simple test or experiment? Get the feedback that you need to know that you're on the right track. And then you can tell me how it goes. We're learning all the time. This is the mindset that these activities require is one of being experimental and of learning. You don't know everything. You can always get better. I'd love to hear your ideas about what you're doing today, or if you try this yourselves, how it works for you. Thank you very much for joining me this evening.
Thanks, Alon. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that you are tuned into the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program this evening is Alon Salant, founder and partner at Carbon 5. The program tonight is Fail Early and Often, Innovative Practices for Online Development. Now, I forgot in the beginning to tell you the Commonwealth Club tradition is to use these question cards. So you should have them on your chair. You might be sitting on them or some right next to you. Paula can give you some if you don't have any yet. Paula we'll be collecting these cards as we go along. So any questions you have for Alon, please write them down on the card and they'll be passed up to me. So I had a question for you. In the meantime, are there any particular tools or techniques that you like? You were telling me something earlier today about this agile poker that you guys play, and which was a pretty cool thing sounding to me. But are there any tools or techniques you would recommend for people, especially as they're getting into this?
I think there's you mentioned planning poker, which I can talk about in a second. There's this idea of finding fun little activities that have a small rule set that you can do at any time with your team. The planning poker example is one that developers use to estimate the work that they're doing. The idea here is it's an optimization exercise. So agile developers usually have a long queue of work that they're working on, and you need to estimate the level of effort for that work so that you can project how long it's going to take you to get to some milestone or to some end goal. And what you do with planning poker is, and you can buy these cards, you can make them yourselves, you can use Rochambeau, which is my preferred mechanism. You take a story, take a feature, and you ask the developers to lay out a card that's the level of effort. And we do effort not in terms of hours or days, but in terms of points, so it's an abstract scale. But the idea is everybody throws out a card. You've got, if it's all threes, great, done. You don't even talk about it. All you've looked at is, like, what is this feature? If there's discrepancy, if you have a high and a low, you have the high and the low discuss. Why did you think that was a one? Why did you think that was an eight? Hopefully you come to some, you let them discuss for a little bit. Maybe you come to agreement, or maybe you don't even come to agreement, and then you vote again. And if you have consensus, you move on. So it's a way of not spending an hour talking about that feature and what it's going to take. It's a way of quickly moving through and having a simple practice for getting a lot of benefits, for getting through the activity that you're trying to do. So there are many. One thing you're seeing is this idea of games is something that's kind of a new idea, and little activities that have a small rule set that have benefit if you do them repeatedly.
Can you give us an example of one of those from one of your clients?
Not right now.
Okay. Okay, then here's one question I got from someone in the back before I came up. What are some mistakes you think would be best to make up front? How do you fail early?
Well, the mistake you're going to make, whether you want to or not, or whether you try to or not, are mistakes around scoping, how long it takes to do things. Developers are horribly bad at estimating the actual time it takes to do things. People say, take what your developer says, double it, add 20%. But if you do that, you're still going to have to double it and add 20%. Somehow it never quite works out. So the making mistakes around estimation is really common. And learning how to – planning poker is one of these examples of a way of having a reliable system of doing estimation that – once you do it for a little while and you take the training wheels off and you have some momentum, can actually stop becoming a risk or a failure. Another one, I think, is planning too big. Even when you try and break things down, it's hard not to get attached to details. That activity of breaking things down is extremely difficult, of actually getting down to that kernel of what's the minimum that we can do, what's the simplest thing that works that meets the goal that I have today. What you'll find is that you'll think you've done that, and then you'll end up spending an extra developer day or two doing something that you could have done without. And so there's kind of time waste that happens there and optimization that you can still do to improve that. What we find is that in the beginning of projects, those are the kinds of things that always happen, and they're very team-dependent and personality-dependent, and so they're the kind of things that you optimize over time.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, well, here's one. If I'm not designing to an end goal, what am I designing for?
So this is, I think, one of the primary objections we hear from designers when we're trying to run an agile software project and we're working with a design firm or an individual designer who hasn't done it before, or who's tried and failed. It's a tough one. I mentioned before that user-centered design and those practices, we typically have seen them in the past done up front. So while it is iterative and recursive and has this experimental attitude, it ends up at an end goal that is, okay, this is the product, this is the thing that now needs to get built, and it gets thrown over to the developers. What we find if you work that way is that you end up revisiting so much stuff. The process of actually building working software provides a lot of input into the design that you have. You might find that elements of the design that are not that important, that don't have high value, are extremely expensive to implement, so you want to get rid of those things. Or that there's things that are easy to do once you've built some infrastructure that would greatly enhance the design, and you've now got an opportunity to do it at low cost. So that doing the design up front doesn't introduce any flexibility to take advantage of wins and to avoid those fails. So the process that I pitch when I'm trying to sell a designer on working with us in an agile way is to take that vision that we're working towards and follow this process of trying to reduce it down to something smaller, something incremental towards that end goal. I don't think it's possible to reduce it down to the cycle that we work on as software developers. We, at Carbon 5, we typically work on a one-week cycle of planning, design, implementation, testing, and release. So a really rapid cycle. I think that's, what we found is that's a little too fast for design. It's developers are able to work on really discrete small pieces, but design does need to be a little bit more holistic. So the strategy that we take or that I preach is take that vision, think about the overall scaffold and the overall architecture of what you're trying to do, but let's come down to something that's kind of the kernel of what we're building, something that we can build in a month maybe, and solve those design problems and then essentially enhance that over time. And what you'll find is that it's actually a process that you do when building a software system. You'll take this working system, this design that you have, and you'll go to add a new component. Either that new component will fit within the design you have or it won't. If it doesn't fit within the design you have, you're going to have to refactor. You're going to have to change your existing design to accommodate this new component. What you'll find then is that the design that you end up having, that you end up iterating towards over time, will have flexibility in those areas where you add new things or where you have change. You'll end up with a more modular system that accommodates the kind of modular stuff that you need to put into your application. So that's the bring it down, set intermediate goals, build towards those goals, iterate on those goals, I think is the best answer that we have today.
That's a good answer. Now, here's a trick question. I didn't write it. For what types of projects does Agile not work well?
Well, if you know everything up front, then this iteration has less value. There's certainly some efficiency and optimization to knowing everything that you have to do, crafting your solution conceptually first, and then building straight towards it without incorporating any feedback into what you're doing. Because that feedback takes time. It takes human energy. Revising things takes time. If you know what you need to do, you know what you're building towards, then you're not going to get as much value out of it and potentially some efficiency in what you're constructing. There's a fallacy in that idea, though, and that is that way more people think they know what they're building than actually do. So if you think you're one of those people who has it all planned out up front and you can just jam straight towards it, you're probably wrong.
Okay, you heard it here first. Can you comment on working with large organizations like Schwab or eBay where there are usually significant internal technical dependencies?
Well, the technical dependencies I don't actually think are an issue. I think the issues there are the cultural or the political environment, and that's where the style flexing stuff comes in. You can't change everybody. You can't change a large organization's policies and practices, but you can find allies at an organization like that, and you can perform your daily practices internally as a team, and then slowly try and expose those out. What we've found is the most effective thing to do is that whole idea of delivering a working system early. If you can put in somebody's hands, your client, working software, something they can respond to, they get engaged and they want to see something new and they want to see the next iteration of it. They're actually willing to start flexing on how they work in order to optimize for that because that's where they get real value. They perceive reduced risk and they just want to see what comes next.
Okay, here's another one. How do you make sure the organization recognizes the value of what you learn from a failure? So In other words, how do you let people know that this failure is important and is beneficial to them?
I guess the answer would be to make sure you learn something from it. I think that's got to be it. You've got to find out what's the value. You've got to feel the value yourself. You've got to find that value. What's the learning that you can then incorporate into the work that you do, and you've got to figure out how to communicate that out. That's the failures themselves don't have any value unless you learn something from them.
And do you find this whole style flexing thing that you guys talk about at Carbon 5, do you find how important? I mean, you're a mathematician and by training, right? And the other programmers and developers. How do you work with marketing teams? Is there a special communication style you've had to learn from mistakes, or have you failed at communicating and learned from that?
I think a similar answer to a couple questions ago, and that's get something in their hands as soon as you can that they can respond to. It's all these ideas are very intangible and have limited value in concept until you actually have something to respond and react to, until you can see that you're getting value out of doing it. And that'll always be the most compelling pitch, is to get something in somebody's hands that they're attached to. So with marketing departments, the marketing departments is where it's easy. It's technology teams and things like that that don't necessarily care as much about product, and they've got questions about scalability and infrastructure. Those can actually be a little harder to address because those things in an agile process are things that you might get to actually later rather than deciding on upfront, and that's, you can get some culture clash around that.
Okay, thank you. There's another question here. I'm not sure if this is appropriate for you guys or not, but any recommendations when working with outsource offshore partners?
Sure. It's not something that we have a ton of experience with. We have some experience with it, and I think where we've seen failures, they've come from a lack of transparency and communication. I think as much as you can figure out how to have that feedback loop and that opportunity for iteration and optimization, so reflection meetings, those conversations, have a clear agreement with the people you're working with that you don't expect it to be going great from the beginning and that you're planning to optimize it, and a commitment from them to give you the transparency that you need to do that. I think offshoring in the same time zone can really help something like that. Making sure you've got allies or project collaborators that speak the same language, things like that. Communication and collaboration, I think, are the keys there.
Okay, thank you. All right, this is a long one. When writing working software for the IDEO project, which you are going to change dramatically based on user testing, do you write the same number of tests for your code? I think that's an insider question, though. Let me read it again, because I'm not even sure what the question is exactly.
Maybe I can explain.
I'm not a developer. So when writing working software for the IDEO project, which you are going to change dramatically based on user testing, do you write the same number of tests for your code?
So the question is really around, do you apply the same rigorous practices to something that you're going to change when you know you're going to change it dramatically? And I think there's a difference between changing it dramatically and just throwing it out. I think there is a role for prototyping, which are just quick and dirty, works right now, done, toss it out, move on. What we were building was something that we expected to stick around. We didn't know the changes that we were going to make. So the answer is, yeah, you've got to apply the same rigor to building that. You don't think of it as a prototype. You think of it as the early inception of the product itself.
Okay. Now, I have one here that I can't read all the writing, so I may get this wrong. But it's a question from right over here. Do you sometimes have to walk away from a client or in-house team that is less flexible in moving and adapting to change to create a better product?
I think the place where we do walk away, or clients walk away from us, but it's before we've even started working together. I think one of the reasons we've been successful in doing the work that we do and been able to learn these practices and apply them to our projects is this is how we have to sell our work. There are lots of projects or lots of clients that come across the table that we don't actually end up spending much time trying to work with because they're so obviously misfits. we don't bid on projects where we can't talk to the people that we're going to be working with. You know, you get these blind bidding processes where you have to submit a proposal and people are going to be evaluating the proposal. I have no idea who the proposals come from. That, in some environments, maybe that works, but it's not a way that you're going to get to work with us because it sets up an expectation and a relationship that has none of the mechanisms in which to be successful in this way.
Can you talk about budget? This sounds expensive. I mean, I don't know if that's something that you're able to talk about tonight, but can you give us some idea of how this works?
I love this question. There's a couple different ways to respond to this. I think the aardvark example of building 50% of your good ideas is a way of addressing the budget question. When we were first practicing Agile, one of the things that we would do with clients or a strategy would take was, let's build something simple, launch it, and then we'll get feedback from users and we'll revise based on that. Now that can work, but you are investing a fair amount of work in building workable, scalable, usable software that you might then toss out the window. So if you can figure out how to spend some of that effort, hopefully it's a smaller percentage than you would spend building something, if you can spend some of that effort on testing and evaluating, discard many of the things that don't work or revise them in such a way that they will work, and actually implement those things that are implemented right the first time or implemented right in the right direction so that you can iterate on them, I think in the end, you'll end up spending less. I think also there is a value that I mentioned kind of in iteration, and that is one of optimization. These practices look for efficiencies everywhere. And if you're doing reflections and in your reflections you're trying to evaluate where are we spending too much time, there's a lot of opportunity for optimization. And so optimization is kind of a core value here. And maybe not in the beginning, you might find your team is churning a fair amount, but by the time you've got a project underway and you're moving smoothly, you can actually have a really finely tuned, very effective team. And so you can do a lot more work than you would otherwise.
So I've got a question for you. This is my own question. Between startups like Aardvark or bigger corporate companies like Schwab, or who are the clients that you find are most exciting to work with? From a personal...
haven't I answered that already? the startups are certainly inspirational. They're where we really get to experiment and to iterate on the way that we work with our clients. And so sometimes the ideas are really wacky, and it's hard to know if they're going to be successful or not. Our job is to get in there and to be effective and efficient and to do our best to help realize a founder's dream.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program tonight where we only have time for one more question. You are listening to Alain Salant, Fail Early and Often, Innovative Practices for Online Development. So here's the last question. I think you may have covered this a little bit, but let's just use this as a wrap-up. What's the role of software architecture if you're not designing up front for the product you are creating? So maybe if you could just give us a summary, really, of your ideas tonight.
Sure. So this is a common question for people who are doing iterative software development and building up a system, is if you're always building up and building the simplest thing that works for you, where does the scaling infrastructure come from? Where does the overarching architecture come from that supports a system? And the answer is that, much as I'd mentioned with the design example, if you start with something simple, well, first of all, we come to this with a lot of experience building software. So when we're building the simplest thing that works, we're doing it with an idea of where we might be changing things to add flexibility and growth and architecture in the future. So there's the simplest thing that works is a version of it that's horribly calcified and brittle and hard to change. And there's a version of the simplest thing that works that's ready for change. And so there is some experience that feeds into that. But where the architecture comes from is each time you're enhancing the simplest thing that works, you look for the opportunity to add generalization, essentially adding architecture to accommodate the change that you're adding. And if you build a system up this way, what you end up with is flexibility and generalization where you make a lot of changes, and brittleness and calcification where you don't make changes. And that's okay. You haven't done architecture work and invested all that time and energy to create abstraction and generalization where you don't need it. You do it incrementally as you go in the places where it has value.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, I want to thank our speaker, Alain Salant from Carbon 5 tonight. And I would like to thank all you audience members for being here today. And now this member of the this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.